Hello, I'm Liz, a newsreader on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 9th of June 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity, Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post. This remains in paper envelopes, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods. Calling 01902 213 210, visiting our website www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Ed, Colin, Craig, Helen, Ian, Simon, Liz, Christine, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country, with the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger, a story about an unusual court case, the weather, Craig's Black Country Joke Book, an edition of Sounds of Nature, a clip from the Leaders Council podcast featuring Beacon CEO Lisa Cowley, and rounding all that off, we get to hear Graham Fisher's In My Opinion feature. But first, we start with our Guess the Sound quiz. It's as simple as the title suggests. I'm going to play a sound clip, and all you have to do is simply guess what it is. So without any further ado, here's this week's clip. Have a ponder on that, and Mina will reveal the answer later alongside the usual quiz answers. Now we start as always with some local news, brought to us by Ian, Angela, Liz, and first up, it's Christine.
Thousands more homes than originally thought will have to be built on greenbelt land as the pressure rises on councils to speed up house building. A new report reveals the shortfall of new homes needed in the Black Country is now 36,819, which has shot up from the 26,920 figure given 2 years ago. And council planners say there are not enough brownfield sites in the region to cope with the growing population. It comes amid campaigns to save areas like the Seven Cornfields in Wolverhampton from development. Walsall Council boss Mike Bird expects the shortfall of homes to continue rising, saying the issue is now at crisis point. Councillor Bird said, "It will keep increasing because the housing shortage is such an issue, we are at crisis point. We have all got to look at the Greenbelt and Walsall is no different. There is pressure on Greenbelt, the whole of the Black Country. But our policy is brownfield first and we will continue to do that." West Midlands Mayor Andy Street said he would work to help increase the number of brownfield sites being put forward for development. Mr Street said, "There is still an incredible amount of derelict brownfield land left to develop, and I remain firmly of the belief that this is the answer to the Black Country's immediate housing needs. I am committed to working with local councils to speed up the number of brownfield sites being brought forward, and we will continue to make government cash available to clean up eyesore sites to pave the way for development. There remains pressure on greenbelt sites in and adjacent to the Black Country, but I will continue to give my full support to councils, communities and campaigners in resisting greenbelt development for years to come."
The impact of COVID-19 on people's mental health could last for up to 2 decades, a hospital chief in the Black Country has warned. David Loughton told a public board meeting the pandemic's effect on people would linger for a considerable amount of time. It came after a senior sister on the intensive care unit at New Cross Hospital spoke of the horrendous impact the virus has had. Mr. Loughton, chief executive of the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust, which runs the hospital, said, "If we go back to Sunday, March the 8th, last year, the first death, it was only the 4th death in the country. Now we're in a different place, and staff need more support now than then. And everyone has heard me say this thousands of times, but nobody went into nursing, nobody went into the NHS to watch death on the scale we've seen." Mr. Loughton said the death toll of the pandemic had been on an unbelievable scale, as he stressed the importance of helping support staff and others to recover from the mental health impact of the virus. He told board members about the particular impact COVID has had on the mental health of young people due to the restrictions put in place, which has led them not being able to see their friends. Geraldine Hardesty from the ICU at the hospital highlighted the pandemic had impacted staff both from a personal and a work point of view, but praised her colleagues for banding together and for the fantastic support offered by the Trust.
New CCTV cameras are set to be fitted as part of plans to tighten security in crime hotspots. Cameras will be up and running in parts of Wolverhampton in a bid to clamp down on burglary, robbery and vehicle theft, the West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner has said. It comes after the City Council received £247,602 in government cash from the Safer Streets Fund. Other recipients of the £18.3 million fund include Staffordshire, West Mercia and Birmingham. Commenting on the funding for Wolverhampton, West Midlands PCC Simon Foster said, "It is good to see we've been able to secure some additional money to make small but not insignificant improvements to our streets. We know there are simple things that can be done to prevent crime, and working with the council, we intend to use this money to do them. We'll tighten security where we think it can be tighter, and we'll make sure CCTV is fitted in crime hotspots." Wolverhampton South West MP Stuart Anderson said, "In my recent Safer Neighbourhood survey, I found that constituents want to see more done to tackle speeding, traffic issues and antisocial behaviour. This fund will help us to crack down on these issues and make our city a safer place to live in, work and visit. I will continue to work with our key partners to ensure that these issues are effectively dealt with."
NHS staff numbers in parts of the West Midlands have shot up by nearly 3,500 over a year, new figures show. According to the Department for Health, the number of NHS workers at health trusts in the Black Country and Birmingham was 83,278 in February 2021, a 4.3% rise of 3,465 staff. The figures include 8,870 doctors, up 5.9%, and 22,203 nurses, a rise of 2.8%. Overall, an extra 1,100 doctors and nurses started with the NHS in the region over the 12-month period. Health and Social Care Secretary Matt Hancock said, "It is hugely encouraging to see the number of doctors and nurses has peaked yet again. Our expanding NHS workforce will help to provide safe care to patients and continue the success of the vaccination programme as we work to tackle backlogs and build back better." Sir Simon Stevens, Chief Executive of NHS England, recently called the increased staffing numbers a nightingale effect, referring to the giant temporary hospital set up during the pandemic in areas including Birmingham. It came as University Admissions Service UCAS revealed that the number of applications to study nursing had risen by 34%. He said, "It is no surprise that given the profession's high profile over the last year, many more people have been inspired to join the NHS's ranks by the so-called Nightingale effect.
Two Black Country councils have confirmed they will be taking in Afghan war veteran families. A national relocation scheme is currently underway for families who supported British troops overseas. The veterans supported British troops on the front line in Afghanistan, helping them with interpretation and translation skills. Walsall and Wolverhampton councils have said they will be taking part in the scheme, which will see local authorities across the country also take part. Neither Walsall or Wolverhampton are yet to say how many families will be taken in and at what dates. It comes as Dudley Council said it will rehome 20 families, with those families first set to arrive in the summer. Councillor Ian Brookfield, leader of Wolverhampton Council, said, "The City of Wolverhampton will certainly be playing our part in the nation's call to help and welcome these brave people who were a vital part of the British Army's operations in Afghanistan. We are working on the exact numbers, but we anticipate it will be a similar number to those we are seeing in other areas across the country." Councillor Mike Bird, leader of Walsall Council, added, "Walsall Council has a history of providing support to resettlement schemes, such as the Syrian Refugees Programme, and we are awaiting more details on the scheme so that we can consider how best to support Afghan veterans and their families in the borough, so they can settle in well and feel they can contribute to Walsall life. Our discussions and plans are still in the very early stages, but like local authorities all across the country, we are happy to help."
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen, back with another roundup of everything that's been going on at the Beacon Centre the past week. And, well, it's been a busy one, as we've been celebrating our volunteers as part of National Volunteer Week. The saying is true: the greatest gift you can give really is your time. And we appreciate our incredible volunteers all year round at Beacon. But during Volunteers Week, we like to pay an extra special thank you to the amazing team who helped do so much for people with sight loss. We're so fortunate to have more than 300 volunteers helping make a difference, and Beacon wouldn't be Beacon without them. Sadly, we weren't able to celebrate as we would like again this year, but we've been sharing our volunteer stories throughout the week, and we wanted to share them with you as well. Among those we spoke to was Peter, who told us that getting to know people and their stories had been a great experience for him. Peter began volunteering with Beacon in our gym, helping our members stay active. During the pandemic, he became one of our invaluable telephone befrienders, and he's also recently joined our staff team as well, where he's putting some of the skills he's picked up into practice in our people department. For anyone considering volunteers, he told us, "I'd say do it." Then we also spoke to Eleanor Mason, who's one of our amazing telephone befriending volunteers. She told us, "Volunteering is really fulfilling, and I think it's good for your own well-being to do something for others. No matter what that might be, it genuinely all makes a difference, and it costs nothing to be kind." I really love that. It really does cost nothing, does it? The role of our telephone befrienders has been more important than ever this past year, with the pandemic keeping so many of us at home. Our befrienders have been doing an incredible job. In a recent survey of beneficiaries, 100% of people we asked said the scheme had improved their physical or emotional well-being. Eleanor is following in the footsteps of her granny, who supported Beacon as well for many years, and all our telephone befrienders who make such a difference for so many people. We also spoke to Val, who has been volunteering with Beacon since 2009. What an incredible achievement! Prior to COVID-19, her role was on reception, and she says she can't wait to get back to the centre. She told us, "I would describe volunteering with Beacon as very self-satisfying, as you get to help in a small way with the wonderful service provided to the visually impaired community. I would also tell people how inspirational all the Beacon members are. All those visiting the centre always look happy and enjoy trying all the activities that are available to them. It makes volunteering most enjoyable." Finally, this week, we didn't want to let Volunteers Week go by without paying tribute to those who we've lost this past year. Sadly, several of our volunteers have passed away. All of them were remarkable people who went out of their way to make a difference for people with sight loss. Among them was John, who'd been collecting donation boxes across the Black Country since 2014 for Beacon. He'd collected more than £31,000, an incredible amount that's helped us make a difference for so many people. John's dedication to the sight loss community was inspiring, and he, along with all the volunteers we've lost this year, is so very missed by everyone at Beacon. That's it for this week. Hopefully, I'll be back to catch up with you all again soon.
Thanks for that update, Helen. Now we have some more local news, brought to us by Ed, Ian, Christine, Liz, and starting first, it's Angela.
Businesses across the region have been enjoying a boost in trade thanks to a combination of good weather, people enjoying time outside their homes, and a more positive outlook. Pubs and restaurants have seen more people coming through their doors over the last few weeks since restrictions were relaxed to allow indoor trading. Half-term holidays have also seen a steady stream of people going out to pubs and restaurants, helped by the hotter and sunnier weather. Rume Manoharan, General Manager of the Greyhound Inn in Lower Penn in Wolverhampton, said the last few weeks had been amazing. He said the weather does help, as it plays a big factor in the fact that people are a lot more comfortable being outside and dining outside. Also, with the weather improving around Whit Week, the bank holiday weekend and half term, a lot more people have been out to see us, and that's been very positive. Mr. Manoharan's positivity has been matched by Peter Towler, owner of Mad O'Rourke's Pie Factory in Tipton. Mr. Towler said that trade had been far better than he had expected over the past few weeks. He said, "We were able to open a while ago because we had a marquee outside, but the last few weeks have seen a massive increase and certainly more than I expected. There is definitely a feel-good factor at the moment, with people able to go out in great spirits, and we have definitely seen that increase in our trade."
An MP has called for the removal of concrete barriers installed on an estate to protect green spaces from illegal traveller camps. Marco Longhi said the barriers on the Milking Bank estate in Dudley were a blot on the landscape and had become a hotspot for antisocial behaviour. The Dudley North MP has urged council chiefs to remove the barriers and replace them with better options, such as timber bollards and wildflowers. He has also suggested local criminals could be brought in to deliver the project as part of the community payback scheme. Mr. Longhi said he had met with council officers to find a way of discouraging youths from congregating, as well as making the area more visually appealing. "I understand why these were installed, but there are much better options," he added. "One solution could be for the area to have wildflowers planted, possibly with timber bollards. This would link in with the council's carbon reduction scheme and would be much more appealing to residents." He added, "I believe a natural barrier to stop incursions will also help tackle the antisocial behaviour issues, and that it would add to the biodiversity of the area, which will benefit the environment and own quality of life. I look forward to meeting with council officers again soon to see what options will work best for the community. The barriers are stationed at the bottom of Salisbury Close, Osberton Drive and Wexford Close, at the back of Meadow Lark Pub."
The City of Wolverhampton Council is calling for volunteers to support the city's growing vaccination offer. To help people get access to the life-saving jab, the council is seeking volunteers to visit neighbours and community members, talk to them about the vaccine and how to get it, and break down barriers preventing uptake. Anyone over the age of 18 who lives or works in Wolverhampton can volunteer, but must be able to travel across the city and expenses will be repaid. Volunteers will also be able to join the Wolverhampton Community Champions Project, a city-wide network of people giving up some of their free time to help friends, family, colleagues and communities to get the facts about COVID-19 and the vaccines and encourage uptake. For more information and to volunteer, please contact community.champions@wolverhampton.gov.uk. Councillor Jasbir Jaspal, the City of Wolverhampton Council's Cabinet Member for Public Health and Wellbeing, said, "We are calling for volunteers to work with us to let households, communities and businesses know that the vaccine is available to them and stress the importance of having it as soon as they can. By going door to door, delivering leaflets or talking to people in shops and businesses, our volunteers are letting people know how easy it is to have the vaccine, breaking down barriers around bookings and addressing myths and misinformation. This means more people having their vaccine and being protected from serious illness and reduced chances for the virus to spread. If you want to help protect your local community and can spare some time, please get in touch."
Fly tippers and litter louts are being targeted as part of a new campaign in Dudley. The Borough Council is encouraging people to organise litter picks as part of Keep Britain Tidy's Great British Spring Clean. It comes 8 months after Dudley Council launched its own version of the Don't Be a Tosser campaign, originally the concept of York Council, in response to the increase in litter and fly tipping during the pandemic. Figures released in 2020 revealed there had been nearly 7,000 recorded incidents of fly tipping in the borough between 2011 to 2012 and 2018 to 2019, costing the council £371,382 in clean-up costs. The borough's beauty spots and green spaces have been particularly targeted by people dumping their waste in areas. Anyone who wants to support the campaign and the Great British Spring Clean can organise a litter pick in their local area and will be able to borrow equipment from the council. Councillor Karen Shakespeare, Dudley Council's Cabinet Member for Public Realm, said, "This campaign ties in perfectly with the Dudley Deal, which is an informal agreement between Dudley Council and anyone who lives, works or runs a business in the borough. We are committed to providing street cleaning services and bin collections, but we are asking everyone else to play their part by disposing of waste responsibly. Fly tipping and littering are not acceptable. It is antisocial and spoils the environment for those who genuinely want to enjoy our green spaces."
Faster trains will travel on an upgraded route through the West Midlands under plans unveiled for a revolution in rail travel. The scheme, proposed by Midlands Connect in a new report, will see the electrification of a new line from Wolverhampton to Shrewsbury in a move that will cut journey times and reduce carbon emissions on the rail network. A new hourly service will run from Shropshire through the Black Country in Birmingham to London, with trains travelling at speeds of up to 90 miles per hour, up to 80% faster than they do now. Transport bosses say the changes will increase capacity, slash journey times, boost local businesses and improve connectivity around the region. They claim upgrading the route will bring £377 million in time savings for passengers and £145 million of environmental benefits. The plans have been submitted to ministers and come after the government announced a major shake-up of rail services under new state-owned body, Great British Railways. Maria Makankosis, Chief Executive for Midlands Connect, said, "This work could create a rail revolution in the Black Country and Shropshire. I know from experience, using this train every day, how overcrowded it can be. The report lays out how businesses, commuters and residents will all benefit from an upgraded route, as will our economy. This is the definition of a win-win project and can help take us from rails to recovery."
Now it's time to get your grey matter working, as we head over to Mina for this week's quiz.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. What animal sleeps with one eye open? Question 2. What powered the earliest vacuum cleaners? Question 3. How heavy is the biggest padlock in the Guinness Book of Records? Question 4. Where was the first McDonald's drive-through? Question 5. What is it that pigs can't do? And question 6. How long did it take for a Swedish lady's lost wedding ring to turn up? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show, but for now, good luck!
Thanks for those questions, Mina. Now we have some more local news, brought to us by Ian, Christine, Angela, Ed. First up, it's Liz.
A warning device linked to a speed tracker will be trialled on canal towpaths in the West Midlands and Staffordshire to encourage cyclists to slow down. The Canal and River Trust is urging cyclists to stay kind, slow down, after an increase in people using the towpaths during lockdown. The device will be set up so anyone cycling below 8 miles per hour will get a thank you message, while faster cyclists will be told to stay kind, slow down. The automated signs will be trialled by the Waterways and Wellbeing Charity for a month in Wolverhampton, Birmingham and Coventry, along with Stone in Staffordshire. Gavin Passmore, Community Engagement Manager at Canal and River Trust, said, "We know that our canals played a crucial role during lockdown for exercise and well-being. This was particularly important in urban areas where many people don't have back gardens, as people stayed local and discovered these amazing wildlife corridors on their doorstep. We want people to use the canals, including cyclists, but ask everyone to be considerate of others on the towpath. While most people are kind and courteous, if you are on a bike, it can just mean slowing down and cycling at a leisurely pace. We're hoping this speed awareness trial makes the cyclists who sometimes do go too fast to think about their speed, acting as a reminder to be considerate."
A new cafe bar has opened in Stourbridge's former co-op store, bringing up to 30 new jobs to the town. Sofio Lounge is part of the Lounges Group that operates 30 cosy clubs and 140 lounges across the country. The fit-out was completed at 111 High Street after agreeing a 15-year lease with commercial property group Evolve Estates. Lounges snapped up the former co-op after London and Cambridge Properties, the Kings Winford-based national commercial property and investment group that manages the building on behalf of Evolve Estates, split the space to create a 3,500 square foot bar on the ground floor. LCP now hopes to convert the first floor space into residential accommodation. The bar operator has spent more than £750,000 fitting out the bar and cafe. Half of the new jobs are full time. Lounges said it's been looking for a suitable site in Stourbridge for some time. Barry Flint, asset manager for LCP, said, "Attracting a national and respected operator such as Lounges is great news for Stourbridge. It will bring a fresh dimension to the leisure scene in the town and bring welcome jobs to the local community."
Poundland is extending the trial of its online delivery service to thousands more customers in the West Midlands. The pilot, based out of Warsaw-based Poundland's new fulfilment centre in Cannock, was quietly tested earlier in the year by 18,000 colleagues and selected guests, offering more than 2,500 products for home delivery. After a positive response, the service last month offered to another 1.8 million households in Birmingham and Walsall postcodes, and is now being rolled out to postcodes in Dudley, Wolverhampton and Stoke-on-Trent as well. The new postcodes include Wolverhampton, WV1 to WV98, Dudley, DY1 to DY14, and Stoke-on-Trent, ST1 to ST21. Wolverhampton postcodes areas include Bilston, Bridge North and Willenhall. The Dudley postcode areas take in Tipton, Briley Hill, Stourbridge, Bewdley, Kidderminster, Kings Winford and Stourport-on-Severn. Customers visiting Poundland's pilot online service can use a postcode checker to see if they are eligible. If there's a match, they're automatically passed through to the shop without any need to register. All the items available online are at the same price as those found in Poundland's 850 stores and will be delivered for a flat fee of £4 regardless of the order size. Initial categories available to buy online include grocery, gardening, entertainment and DIY, Pep & Co Home, health and beauty, household and pet, and stationery and crafts. Poundland has partnered with Hermes to provide logistics services as it extends the pilot.
Vandals went on a wrecking spree at a park, destroying a war hero's roll of honour for the second time. Information boards at Graysbrook Memorial Park in Dudley were installed to commemorate the lives of people from the borough who lost their lives in both world wars as part of a £60,000 makeover. The work by the Friends of Buffery Park had involved refurbishing a cross in the centre of the park and adding the boards. The latest attack marks the second time the boards have been vandalised after they were smashed and the posters torn to shreds in November 2019. Secretary of Friends of Buffery Park Group, which also looks after Graysbrook Memorial Park, Lynn Horton, said it was hard to take in what had happened after the work that had gone in to create the boards. She said, "So much time, effort and money has gone into these boards, with our chairman, Steve Briscoe, working tirelessly to find out all the information for the boards. After all that, it's terribly sad to find out that people have gone and vandalised these boards, and I really can't believe anyone would do something like this to a war memorial garden." Mrs. Horton said the group was looking at help with funding for replacing the boards, but didn't have the funds at the present time. She said, "We've spoken to the police and they're trying to get us some funding, as any funding we have is committed to extending the play area at Buffery Park. Because of that, we haven't got anything spare at the moment because that is costing us £10,000. My message to whoever did this would be that I can't believe they could do this, as these men died for us and they should know better."
The world's best snooker players will be coming to the region for one of the sport's biggest tournaments. Alderslea Leisure Village in Wolverhampton will host the Kazoo Players' Championship, marking the first time the village has held a major snooker event. The venue has previously hosted the PDC Grand Slam of Darts and a host of big comedy events at the multi-purpose venue. The world ranking event will run from February the 7th to the 13th in 2022 and will feature an elite field of the top 16 players on the 2021-22 one-year ranking list. John Higgins won the title last year, playing some of the best snooker of his career, as he beat Ronnie O'Sullivan 10-3 in the final, having come through a field of Q Kings, including Judd Trump, Mark Selby and Neil Robertson. It's the second of three events in the 2021-22 Kazoo series and will receive extensive live television coverage on ITV. Wolverhampton Council Cabinet Member for City Environment and Climate Change, Councillor Steve Evans, said, "We are absolutely delighted the World Snooker Tour has chosen Wolverhampton to stage one of its prestigious televised events. This is all part of our overall five-year event strategy to bring the very best in art, music and sport to the city, to boost the local economy, create new jobs and build an outstanding cultural reputation."
Now we have a clip from the latest episode of the Leaders Council podcast, which features Beacon CEO Lisa Cowley.
Now, joining me on today's programme on what is a bright spring morning here in the capital is Lisa Cowley. Lisa is the CEO at Beacon, a health and social care charity based in the Black Country. Lisa, very warm welcome to yourself today, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the show.
Good morning. No problem at all. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful having you with us as well, Lisa. I think we should start by addressing the elephant in the room, and that's the fact that we are recording this podcast in late May 2021. And so we are still very much in the grip of the global COVID-19 pandemic and have been for the best part of 14 months. And given that you are a charitable organisation that works within that health and social care sector that's very much been on the front line throughout all of this, I'd be interested to understand to what extent all of this has affected you and your operations.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's been a very difficult time for everybody, but working in the health and social care sector, it's been traumatic and chaotic, but also very rewarding at times. So we are a health and social care therapy that support people impacted by sight loss and other long-term conditions. And we do that in a range of ways, from kind of practical support around how they can manage their conditions, to social activities, support getting back into employment and skills. But probably one of the most significantly impacted areas is we are a frontline social care provider. So we have a facility at our main centre where there are 71 apartments where we support people, and we also support people in their own homes. Obviously, being in health and social care, we began our planning around the impact that COVID may have early in 2020. And we undertook an exercise where we trained staff across the organisation to support those key areas. So the frontline roles that people needed our support in order to continue to live within their own homes and be independent. We finished that at 12:30 on a Friday in late March, and at 4:30 we had confirmation that one of the people that we cared for who'd been in hospital had indeed tested positive for COVID-19, which meant that a third of our staff were categorised as a contact, because at that point we were not provided with any PPE or protection measures. So we had to step into the front line. So myself and a number of other staff worked on that front line. I in fact lived at the centre on a camp bed for a number of weeks so that I could support the frontline team while leading the organisation, mainly in the evenings and at night. And I think that was, you know, an extremely difficult time. We had a number of people that we cared for that got COVID. We had staff that got COVID, volunteers. We sadly lost members of our Beacon family. We view our organisation as a family. And that was very difficult for people. But we're also very optimistic, and I think it provided us with opportunities to do different things and learn new things. And from my point of view, I got to literally work alongside some of the team that I knew very well, but got to know so much better, and got to spend time with some of our residents that I wouldn't normally manage to spend that amount of time with. So I think even in these really difficult and traumatic times, there's always a positive message you can bring from it. And I think being in a leadership role, I've always felt that to lead, you need to understand your organisation, and it gave me a huge opportunity to do that. And it also gave an opportunity to raise awareness of some of the challenges we face every day with more senior leaders. I've had statements read at the Health and Social Care Select Committee. I've fed into national reviews about the health and wellbeing of staff that work within the health and social care sector. We've fed into national work in relation to the accessibility of healthcare for people, especially those that are impacted by sight loss. And I think there's been a real transition and a recognition of the impact that the social care sector, and specifically the voluntary sector, has had during this time. It's really been a lifeline for people.
I think what this pandemic certainly has done is it's raised awareness among the general public of just the scale of the lingering problems there are in the health and social care sector. And there's been so much goodwill toward those frontline workers, those care workers that have been sort of working on the front lines throughout this pandemic. We've seen people taking to their doorsteps on a Thursday night and clapping for those carers on numerous occasions. And with that sort of momentum growing there, do you think that this can be used as a conduit for the change that the sector needs in the future?
I really hope so. You know, I think people will have seen the white paper that's come out and the views about looking at much more integrated care systems. And I think, you know, the reality is we're not a different person when we're in hospital or when we're in a GP surgery or when we're in our own home, when we're with our friends and family, or when we're having social care. You know, and we've got to be able to integrate that support and really communicate and work as one integrated team to help people and ensure that they can continue to live their life, whether that they need support due to their age, due to conditions, due to a long-term or a short-term illness, it shouldn't impact on their ability to be recognised as a part of society. And I think social care has often been that kind of hidden part. And actually, social care is not just about older adults. And it's not just about people that are in care homes. You know, there are lots of people of all ages that require support, and there are far more people that are supported within their own home or within independent living than are within care home facilities. And I think one of the things that's been really positive, and I think that's probably something that will come from this podcast, is that, you know, I'm always looking for those positives, is that recognition, not just from the general public, but from partners across all sectors of the benefit of an effective social care system, and that actually that, you know, it has been struggling. It's been struggling from a funding perspective. It's been struggling from a support perspective and a kudos. You know, I think, you know, people now recognise that caring is a profession. And I said to, you know, a lot of my team, it is a calling. It is something that not everybody can do. And that it deserves respect. And quite often when people were being taken into hospital or required additional support from clinical services, you know, it was our care team that know those people far better than anybody else, you know, and were able to really support and ensure that they weren't in hospital for any longer than they needed to be and that they got the right care. And I really hope that that momentum is pushed forward at a political level, but also at a societal level, and that we recognise that that's something that, you know, we don't want to forget, that we're all going to at some point need support, whether that's healthcare support or social care support, and that we need to be pushing that agenda as much as possible.
If you'd like to listen to the full episode of the Leaders Council podcast, you can find it by searching for the Leaders Council podcast in any podcasting app of your choice. Coming up now, we have some more local news. And starting this off, it's Ian.
The dates for Sedgley's annual beer festival have been brought forward a week. The event at First Sedgley Scout headquarters of Ladies Walk had been set for September the 24th and 25th. It will now take place on Friday, September the 17th and Saturday, September the 18th. The Real Ale event, which also features cider and gin and live music, is organised by a team from the First Sedgley Scout Group. It raises funds for the group and also supports different good causes and charities. Last year's festival, which would have been the 8th, had to be cancelled due to the coronavirus pandemic. The organisers bring in beers from all over the Midlands and further afield for the festival.
A Friends group and a Park Watch group are being set up to rejuvenate and look after Wolverhampton's East Park. Councillors Anwyn Muston and Phil Page are restarting the Friends and Park Watch groups and have arranged a public meeting to hear residents' views. Councillor Muston said, "East Park has always been the poorer of the city. It was done to a budget. Whilst we talk about the North and South divide, we need to talk about the East and West divide to make sure residents get a fair share of facilities. We're re-establishing the Friends group and they will help bring in more money. We also want to set up a park watch group, which is important. We've had a lot of vandalism around here. The bandstand has been damaged. It's important we keep up surveillance. I've asked for CCTV. We also need to look at park activities. If we're going to have a bandstand, let's use it. We're also looking at other ways to improve the park. Unless the residents back the councillors, we won't get very far."
A lifeline of £51,000 has been raised for Dudley Zoo after one of the hardest 12 months in its 84-year history. After three lockdowns and months of the zoo being closed, the zoo launched an appeal to cover the animal care costs. More than 2,000 people have since donated £51,000, which has provided a much-needed lifeline. And bosses at the zoo have thanked those who have helped it through such a tough time. Derek Grove, zoo director, said, "As it's Love Your Zoo Week this week, we'd like to say a big thank you to all of our supporters who have helped us raise £51,000. having to endure three lockdowns with zero income combined with animal care costs meant we were reaching crisis point, but we've been totally overwhelmed and grateful by the donations we've received. The zoo gave examples of what the money will go towards. £1,200 enables them to feed and care for their Humboldt penguins for 1 month. £1 covers the upkeep and care of one lemur a day. £20 feeds one sloth for 1 week. £100 covers the care of their Asiatic lions for 1 week. £15 enables them to feed their giraffes for 1 day. And £250 covers the cost of a week's portion of fish for their sea lions. The Castle Hill-based attraction reopened its doors on April the 12th as part of the government's roadmap out of lockdown.
An apprentice and student has proved he really is a bright spark after winning a national skills competition. Tom Tyler, aged 22, an apprentice at RS Electrical in Cannock and student at the City Wolverhampton College, has won the Sparks magazine Learner of the Year competition. He pocketed a cash prize of £1,000 and has also been given the prize of a combination drill and some workwear. Tom managed to beat off tough competition from six other participants during the live finals of the competition, which were held on the 20th of May. In the final round, Tom had to carry out the installation of a lighting circuit, two power socket circuits, and a cooker circuit in 5.5 hours. His work was judged by a representative from the National Association of Professional Inspectors, as well as testers and two assessors from the magazine. Tom combines working for RS Electrical while studying for the City and Guild's Level 3 electrotechnical qualification at college. He said, "The tasks I had to complete during the competition were challenging. However, thanks to the skills and knowledge I've gained through my apprenticeship, I felt confident completing what was required. I'm over the moon to have won and would like to thank my employer and tutors at the college for the support they've given me throughout my training and in preparing for the competition."
An ancient Iron Age hill fort on Kinver Edge will be preserved for the future through vital works by a group of National Trust rangers and volunteers. Kinver Hill Fort is thought to date back to the late Bronze Age, with pieces of the fort visible to those visiting Kinver Edge. But heavy rain and visitors trudging over the top of it has caused significant soil erosion and damage to the monument's man-made ramparts. To recreate the original profile of the fort, the team lifted and spread the contents of 800 soil-filled sandbags from the top of the steep ramparts. Lead ranger Ewan Chapman said it is vitally important we do everything we can to protect this special archaeological feature. Kinver Edge is designated a site of special scientific interest, which means we can't bring soil in from elsewhere to repair the earthworks because it will disrupt the sensitive ecology of the area. Over the last couple of years, the ranger team has been scraping soil at Kinver to create bare ground habitat for solitary bees, flies and wasps. The repair works carried out at Kinver Hill Fort is part of a management agreement with Historic England. The work being undertaken is vital to ensure the monument will be preserved for the future and will reduce further loss.
It's time once again to hear from Flashback Roger, who has for us some more amazing facts.
Hello again, everyone. This week's batch really surprised me, so I hope that you're really surprised too. So without further ado, I shall begin. Now, did you know that dolphins sleep with one eye open? The marine mammals have developed a neat trick of maintaining partial consciousness by being able to keep one eye open even as part of their brain sleeps. One of the earliest known vacuum cleaners was so large that it had to be hauled from house to house by a horse-drawn carriage. Its giant hoses were popped through the windows of customers, and a gas-powered motor generated the suction that pulled the dirt and debris into the glass container where onlookers could gawk at the volume of filth coming from their neighbours' homes. Created by a team of students and teachers at the Pavlovo Arts College in Russia, the largest padlock in the world, according to Guinness World Records, measured 56.8 inches tall, 41.3 inches wide, and 12.2 inches deep. Altogether, this hefty lock, including keys, weighs £916. Whatever it's protecting, presumably, is worth a lot more than the lock. The first McDonald's drive-thru was installed in a restaurant based in Arizona, located near a military installation. Military rules forbade the soldiers from wearing their military uniforms in public, and they weren't about to change into civilian clothes just to grab a burger and run back to base. So the restaurant manager, David Rich, came up with a solution. He cut a hole into the wall to allow members of the military to pick up their orders without stepping out of the car. The convenience and simplicity of the idea quickly caught on. And pigs don't sweat. If someone tells you they're sweating like a pig, you might want to point out to them, if you're that sort of person, that they're not being absolutely biologically correct, because that would mean that they're not sweating at all. Swine are born without sweat glands, so when they need to cool off, their only option tends to be to find a cool puddle of mud in which they can roll around. A woman in Sweden lost her wedding ring while cooking for Christmas in 1995. She looked everywhere for it and even had her kitchen floor pulled up, hoping she could find it. But she wouldn't see it again until 2012. While gardening 16 years later, she found the ring around a carrot that was sprouting there. The only explanation was that the ring must have been lost in the vegetable peelings that were turned out into compost. I suppose you could say it was a one carat ring. Well, that's it for this week, folks, and I hope that you were as surprised as me at these little gems. Well, a cuppa and a slice of bread pudding are waiting for me, so I'll clear off and tuck in. See you next week, so keep well and safe. I'll say bye for now. Ta-ra a bit.
Thank you very much for those, Roger. Fascinating as always. Now we head over to Mina for this week's weather.
The weather for this week ahead once again looks to be settled and warm. Temperatures will be steady throughout the week, hovering around 23 degrees. UV levels are expected to be moderate to high throughout the week. The sunrise and sunset times are 4:45 a.m. for the sunrise and 9:31 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday, 11th of June, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 23 degrees. On Saturday, 12th of June to Monday, 14th of June, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 24 degrees. And on Tuesday, 15th of June through to Thursday, 17th of June, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 21 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Thanks for that weather update, Mina. Now we head over to Sounds of Nature, which this week is brought to us by Ed.
The merlin is a small falcon, not much bigger than a blackbird. Merlins have blunt tails and compact, broad-based wings that are pointed at their tip. Their small size allows them to hang in the breeze as they pursue their prey. Merlins feed on small birds, especially meadow pipits, which they chase in flight low to the ground, and they nest on the ground amongst the heather.
This recording was made by Lawrence Shove and was made available by the British Library. Coming up next, we get the latest football news, brought to us by Ian.
Hello, I'm Ian, and here's your latest football news. Bruno Lage has arrived in Wolverhampton and is ready to be confirmed as Wolves' new boss. Having flown over on Monday night, the 45-year-old Portuguese is thought to have spent today meeting staff at the club while getting everything ready for an official announcement. That announcement is expected to be made this week, and he will then return to his homeland, coming back ready for when Wolves start pre-season next month. Larja, who is coming in following Nuno Espirito Santo's departure last month, was granted a work permit by the FA last week. Wolves are not expected to announce Larja's backroom staff just yet, as they also need to go through the work permit process. Larja, a client of Jorge Mendes, lifted the Primeira Liga title at previous club Benfica in 2018 and 2019. He has served as an assistant at both Sheffield Wednesday and Swansea, while also spending the best part of a decade coaching in Benfica's youth ranks. His predecessor, meanwhile, is reportedly close to taking the reins at Premier League rivals Crystal Palace. Having been in discussions with both Palace and Everton, he is now said to be holding advanced talks with the former about succeeding Roy Hodgson, and could put pen to paper by the end of the week. Nuno's exit from Wolves was officially by mutual consent, although the club are understood to have instigated the move after finishing 13th in the top flight last season. David Wagner is in advanced talks to become Albion's next manager. However, the German head coach was not the number one target for the club. Instead, their preferred candidate was ex-Sheffield United boss Chris Wilder. The 53-year-old enjoyed fantastic success while in charge of the Blades, but he also clashed publicly with their owner, and that public spat ensured Albion's owner Guochuan Lai vetoed a move for Wilder, despite the fact the Yorkshireman was keen on the role. With Wilder out of the running, Albion conducted a thorough interview process which ended over the weekend, and it was Wagner who is understood to have impressed them most with talks with the German now at an advanced stage. The German boss famously guided Huddersfield into the Premier League back in 2016-2017 and then defied the odds to keep them up the following year. Despite his heroics at the club, Wagner left Huddersfield by mutual consent in January 2019, with the club sitting bottom of the Premier League. In May 2019, he was appointed as manager of Schalke, but he was sacked in September 2020 following a run that saw the Bundesliga side fail to win in 18 league matches. Yesterday morning, you could find odds of 12-1 with bookmakers for Wagner taking charge at the Hawthorns, but those odds have now been slashed to 10-1 on. Both Wagner and the Baggies will now look to iron out any remaining details, and if they are able to reach an agreement, an appointment could be made within the next 48 hours.
Now we head over to Colin, who shares with us a story about an unusual court case.
Hello, I'm Colin. I'm going to tell you about a rather unusual court case. On a hot summer's day in 1929, Police Constable Plum, while on point duty, removed his helmet and wiped his brow. A newspaper photographer who happened to be passing snapped the constable unawares. That evening, a picture of the incident appeared in the papers, with the caption, "A warm arm of the law wipes the sweat from his brow." Both PC Plum and his wife thought it was a rather good photo, and so did everyone else. Before the year was out, PC Plum had retired from the force and entered the service of the post office. Imagine his surprise when, 5 years later, the old photograph appeared in an advertisement accompanied by the words, "Phew! I'm going to get my feet into a Jay's fluid foot bath." Plum's uncle, a keen student of contemporaneous literature, had noticed the photograph and sent it to his nephew. Relatives and friends soon became aware of the advertisement and took no time in speaking or writing to the ex-policeman about it. The attention worried Mr. Plum because, as a public servant, any employee dealing in publicity was looked on in great disfavour by the post office. He felt that the public would naturally assume that he'd given permission for this use of his photograph, and that the more commercially minded reader would assume that he'd been paid for it. But most of all, Plum resented the suggestion that his feet were smelly, something his best friends might never have told him. So the former police officer went to law and sued the makers of Jay's Fluid for libel. In due course, a statement of claim was drawn up. It contained the innuendo on which the plaintiff relied, namely that the publication implied that by reason of slovenly and unclean habits, the general condition of his feet was so unpleasant that a bath or a wash would be inadequate, and that only a solution of J's sanitary compound would be necessary to deodorize or disinfect his feet. The defendants answered that there was nothing defamatory in implying that a man needed or wanted to use J's fluid on his feet. But counsel for Mr. Plum refused to admit that personal remarks could be made about policemen's feet, except perhaps their size. At the trial, Mr. Plum was cross-examined by Norman Burkett, KC, whose experience in taking evidence was matched only by Plum giving it. "Do you entertain some dim recollections of your days as a policeman?" "Yes." "Happy days?" "Some were." "Do you seriously suggest that anybody looking at this advertisement would say that you've got bad feet?" "Yes. The advertisement for J's says that it's good for feet or smelling feet." "Then do you agree that a policeman standing on a beat in all sorts of weather is the kind of man who would benefit by a footbath?" "Why, yes, he would." "Is anybody going to think worse of you because you have a footbath?" "No, but this is associated with disinfectant. I would use a footbath because my feet ached and not because they were smelly." "Supposing they did smell, do you think you would be unique in the world, or that ordinary people's feet smell as a common thing?" "They may do, but it's possible to use bath salts quite differently from J's fluid." "Do you think that your reputation would be enhanced if you washed your feet in scented salts?" Mr. Plum responded by saying that anybody reading the advertisement would think that his feet smelled so highly that he needed J's fluid. And in fact, the advertisement had led to jokes being told against him. It had caused bad feeling in the family, making him lose his temper at times over the continual joking about it, and had led to family arguments. Norman Burkett spoke strongly to the jury. "I have heard of families being broken up in the divorce courts, but I have never heard about families being broken up by J's fluid." Notwithstanding Mr. Burkett's arguments, the warm arm of the law protected the feet of its old servant. The jury awarded Mr. Plum £100 in damages, about £7,000 in today's money, together with his costs.
Cheers for that, Colin. Now we'll have the Craig. He shares with us some jokes from his Black Country joke book.
A white van man asked the bloke who's passing on the street, "Excuse me, mate, does you know if there's a B&Q in Wolverhampton?" The bloke on the street said back to him, "Sorry, mate, I do, but I know there's 2 D's in Dudley." Here's another one for you. What time is it when you have a pie on your clock? Summit to it. And finally, what's the difference between a buffalo and a bison? You can't wash your hands in a buffalo.
Thanks for those rib ticklers, Craig. Now we head over to Mina, who has for us the answers to this week's quiz.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. What animal sleeps with one eye open? The answer, a dolphin. Question 2. What powered the earliest vacuum cleaners? And the answer here is a gas motor. Question 3. How heavy is the biggest padlock in the Guinness Book of Records? And the answer here is 916 pounds. Question 4. Where was the first McDonald's drive-thru? And the answer, Arizona, USA. Question 5. What is it that pigs can't do? And the answer here is, they can't sweat. And finally, question 6. How long did it take for a Swedish lady's lost wedding ring to turn up? Wait for it. 16 years. Wow. How did you do? Great, I hope. But if not, there's always another chance to have another go next week. Now, did you get the answer to guess the sound question that Rob asked at the start of the show? Here's one more chance to hear it before I tell you the answer. The sound you just heard was a recording of a ringing bell on an electric tram. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, we now head over to Graham Fisher for another edition of In My Opinion.
Hello. The foundations of laws of the United Kingdom are framed on precedents and mores stretching back for hundreds of years in a contiguous pedigree unrivalled in any other part of the Western world. Consequently, with such a history and the practice of fine-tuning, English law is almost universally unequivocal. By this I mean that, barring the occasional notable exception that usually follows a knee-jerk reaction in the something-must-be-done faculty of legislature, look no further than the reprehensible Guard Dogs Act of 1975, since largely amended, UK criminal law is clear, unambiguous, and, crucially, quite absolute. Consider, for example, the law on theft, as described in the Theft Act 1968, arguably one of the most effective pieces of legal drafting in the post-war era, that, though subsequently amended, still has this definition in Section 1, Subsection 1, at its core. A person is guilty of theft if he dishonestly appropriates property belonging to another with the intention to permanently deprive the other of it. That's it. That's just beautiful. No argument. Simple, concise, unconditional, and devoid of the taxing minutiae that bedevil philosophers in deliberating how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. But therein lies the paradox in its absolutism. Dishonestly appropriate a battleship or a biro, it's still theft, and there is no accommodation in the definition for the magnitude of the acquisition, let alone the context or the mens rea, i.e. the intentional knowledge of the perpetrator, that then evokes questions of personal circumstances and mental state at the time of the offence. Fortuitously, entwined throughout the legal system, are the checks and balances that mitigate overzealous interpretations of statutes or the common law. The enviable tradition of trial by jury has its roots in Anglo-Saxon England, and the establishment of the magistracy dates back to the Justice of the Peace Act of 1361, many of the provisions of which are still in force today. Standing accused in front of one's fellow man or woman, females were first allowed on juries in 1920, affords judgment within the paradigm of honest and reasonable belief in strict liability cases and the taking into account of mitigations and defences. Whilst not unique in this regard, the UK is up there in best practice. Conversely, the assiduously unyielding observance of every dot and full stop is a prerequisite to a totalitarian state. We don't do that. Thus has the law matured over the centuries, millennia even, into what we now take for granted as the cornerstone of a democratic, law-respecting society. However, and mindful that rushed law is inevitably bad law with all that entails for civic respect of it, I detect a shift in this exemplar away from our time-served protocols and in a way that, though well-intentioned, may ultimately not bode well unless that historical balance is maintained. And I lay the cause at the feet of a trend that, coincidentally or otherwise, has seemed to proliferate commensurate with the prevalence of social media and its propensity to disseminate passion and subjectivity long before reason and objectivity have had time to strap their boots on, and that is the unfettered exposure and corrosive prosecution of the ism. There is a correlation here with the medical world where the suffix itis, which simply means inflammation, can be appended to just about anything to describe a genetic condition pertaining to the prefix. For example, appendicitis or inflammation of the appendix. Similarly, arthritis, gastritis, fibrositis, and so forth. Similarly, the suffix ism can be applied to elucidate a syndrome or a collation of signs and symptoms that are correlated with each other in a particular point of reference as described by the prefix. Some are munificent or benign conditions, hence altruism, philanthropism. Others may be more provocative, either in a positive or negative extent, depending on the perspective of the proponent, to wit, feminism, chauvinism, anti-Semitism. That one seems to merit a chapter all of its own. Ageism, sexism, despotism, fundamentalism, and the granddaddy of them all, racism. A perpetual thorn in the pan-societal rump that varies in its discomfiture depending on which side one sits, but which, despite occasional relief by shuffling around, never seems to completely go away, and a topic that rouses emotions well above its weight, even at the mention of its name. This exceptionally pernicious ism is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against someone of a different race based on the belief that one's own race is superior. Gosh, even the taciturn description of the condition cries out for an emollient to soothe the unease. Little wonder its practical application can realise such devastating consequences. Yes, indeed, the OED definition is textually elegant in being unequivocal and absolute. But I contend that, just as with our definition of theft, which is trite in a comparison of gravitas but nonetheless amply makes the point regarding their mutual clarity, it must be interpreted within the round. This is not to dilute that interpretation, but to aid the mix to the desired strength in a holistic solution of minimal toxicity. Now, that's not the sort of sentence that one should leave unattended for too long, so I think I'd better explain my reasoning behind it. Let's start with Idi Amin, a Ugandan military officer who served as president from 1971 to 1979. Being popularly known as the Butcher of Uganda probably says it all about this particularly abominable psychopath. He's considered one of the most brutal despots in world history, and his rule was characterized by rampant human rights abuses, political repression, ethnic persecution, extrajudicial killings, nepotism, corruption, and gross economic mismanagement. International observers estimate that up to 500,000 people were killed under his regime. Now that's a top-of-the-range racist at the peak of his game. Then there's the equally charming Robert Mugabe. Having dominated Zimbabwe's politics for nearly four decades, he stands accused of being a dictator responsible for economic mismanagement, corruption, anti-white racism, human rights violations, and crimes against humanity. And finally, in this trio diabolique, I give you Adolf Hitler. What more need one say? Historian Ian Kershaw neatly sums up this ultra-egotistical maniac in one coruscating sentence. Never in history has such ruination, physical and moral, been associated with the name of one man. Sadly, the list goes on, engulfing at various times huge swathes of humanity under its scope of malevolence. Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Pol Pot, Eugene Terblanche. At a local level, we can cite the killers of Stephen Lawrence as representative of a sad litany of ethnically motivated serious crimes that are now endemic in many of our major cities. Racists, every man jack of them, and all fitting squarely into our definition. Now, compare and contrast these with the example from March 2019 of a BBC interview in which white politician Amber Rudd referred to black politician Diane Abbott as coloured. Notwithstanding the former was being supportive of the latter in sympathising with her treatment on social media and elsewhere, which per se is patently offensive, the use of that one word sparked Twitter storms of controversy. Abbott herself said, The term coloured is an outdated, offensive and revealing choice of words. Note to self. Revealing of what exactly? Whilst Daniel Rowley, the Labour MP for Midlothian, helpfully tweeted, Amber Rudd undermining an important point about online abuse by referring to Diane Abbott as a coloured woman on at BBC Radio 2. She clearly gets her language from the same bygone era as her abhorrent welfare policies. Really? The inferences were clear. In fact, there are those who went beyond inference in ramping up the rhetoric to declare Rudd a blatant racist, and thanks to the miracles of technology, a hitherto essentially private spat was opened up for unencumbered comment across the planet from those who also felt offended by proxy on Ms. Abbott's behalf. Rudd responded to the storm with a dignified apology. Mortified at my clumsy language and sorry to at Hackney Abbott, she tweeted, My point stands that no one should suffer abuse because of their race or gender. Quite right, though here is a fascinating fact, courtesy of the Wikipedia School of Philosophy. The term women of colour surfaced in the USA in the violence against women movement. In the late 70s, it unified all women experiencing multiple layers of marginalisation with race or ethnicity as a common issue. Back in the 1960s, I remember the first boy of West Indian descent to join our otherwise all-white infant school. They were interesting times as we adjusted to this strange newcomer and vice versa. His name was Tony and we became good friends for a while until our paths parted on changing schools. It was all a very long time ago, but I well recall how any signs of inappropriate conduct towards him were quickly diffused by our teachers literally banging heads together. Altogether now, all of those over a certain age who remember when teachers actually did that. Nowadays, of course, the expression is purely allegoric, and anyone below state retirement age would not even appreciate the metaphor, let alone its efficacy in modifying errant juvenile behaviour. How times change. 60 years later, Amber Rudd committed the cardinal error of negotiating the hot embers of personal sensitivities whilst wearing hobnail boots instead of ballet shoes. Perhaps her comments were crass, insensitive, maybe for someone who should be expected to have well-honed political antennae, even misguided or plain ignorant. But in denouncing her as a racist, are we truly comfortable in conflating this unfortunate episode with that same fire-breathing chimera of hatred and bigotry that begat the likes of Amin, Mugabe and Hitler? Ah, thank goodness for those historic aspects of our legislature, the glues that bind us, that have over centuries become embedded in our cultural psyche, and which allow us to identify the degree of culpability and, in turn, avoid us treading the slippery slopes towards despotism. But in doing so, we must also respect the delicacy of the dividing line. At the end of the day, steal a battleship or steal a barrow. Theft is theft and it's wrong. Racism is racism. That is wrong too and must be countered with that ultimate vigour with which we defend all of our values. Yet, in apportioning to transgressors the appropriate measure of criticism, censure or punishment, it will remain to our eternal credit as a society that we continue to exercise the judgment of degree.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!